A few weeks ago, a doctor gave me a prescription for acid reflux medication.
Alright.
4 or 5 days after that, for a couple of days I started feeling like progressively more tired, a little bit groggy, and then got hit with vertigo out of the blue.
Describe vertigo.
Have you ever drank so much that you woke up the next morning still kind of drunk?
Yeah, absolutely.
That happened to me this morning.
There you go. It's like that feeling all the time.
Actually, it did happen.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you get randomly get nauseous.
Could you eat food while you're...
Yeah. Food doesn't help. It, yeah. It's just like being hungover.
But you have no idea there was, like, inner ear infection or something?
No, I had a physical the day that I got the prescription. No inner ear, like, infection,
so
no virus, nothing.
You just stopped the prescription and did it go away?
It took about 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's scary.
So for the better part of last week, I was lying around.
Could you like, read or could you watch TV or were you just in
I could watch TV. Looking at
in
a computer.
An isolation chamber.
Yeah, like, what was the worst trigger? Like, what just, you're like.
What the worst trigger?
Like looking out the window?
No, probably looking at a computer screen.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's the weirdest things that'll do it.
How convenient.
Yeah. Right, I know, yeah.
Sorry, yeah. It's just whenever I stare at my laptop, I get vertigo.
Yeah.
But not the TV.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
No, Price is Right is just fine, actually.
I got to watch the first 2 seasons of Vikings. That was
Vikings?
Fun.
What's that?
It's a TV show on History Channel.
Is it about Vikings?
It's about Vikings.
I meant to watch that. Isn't there supposed to be a... Oh, that's the movie Vikings where there's like no dialogue. But the TV show is like History Channel, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I watched it on Hulu.
No
but,
dialogue
movie?
Like a couple words. And then the director is at the tip of my tongue. I can't think of it. But yeah, there's like 5 words of dialogue. It's just all grunting and slashing, apparently.
Probably historically relevant,
too.
Right?
I haven't looked at it yet. Yeah. So we're with Richie Zamore. You're currently phase two, right?
Yes.
What's your title there?
Senior Digital Strategist.
And where are we sitting, this lovely corner?
We are sitting in the patio of my beautiful apartment complex.
Okay. So there's literally, this is the most listeners we've ever had. There's probably 300 people who can hear us right now.
Yeah. It's
like
people looking out their windows wondering who these weirdos are recording in our...
Somebody's going to be throwing tomatoes soon, which is why we got the umbrella up.
Yeah.
Why we're talking to you is your passion about all things digital, and in particular, what was the title we came up with?
I don't
Making
know.
The changes
data-driven
to your website
decisions
based on what your organizational priorities are and testing them relatively efficiently.
It's two tweets.
That
That's
right
actually an acronym.
It's a two-tweet title.
It's an acronym. Blackamachifer. That's what it is. What was the concept? You guys, I was setting up the audio gear. I wasn't paying attention to you. So what are we talking about?
Oh, we rambled about a lot of things. But I think what it came back to is how do you make decisions for your organization driven by data and testing? And so I think the idea was so you're not spending a lot of money.
Right. It's like how can you
be more efficient and more effective with every dollar you have.
Right. How do you make the best investments in technology without having to spend a lot of time designing and building something up front?
So right. what's a good example of not doing that?
I think most nonprofit website projects we've worked on, if
last
not all.
Client of mine that you worked with?
Yeah, where it takes twice as long and twice as much money to build the site because the client assumed there's all these things that need to get built, but they didn't really actually solve any business problem. Which is common, right? And I think part of it comes down to how these projects get funded, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I faced the exact same problem during my years at Salsa, where you'd have these organizations that have been around for several decades, and you think they have their data together or kind of their own internal processes down, and they would come to you, and they would be asking you the same questions that the nonprofit that doesn't even have a tech status has. And it'd be like, you don't even have any of your own needs written down. Like, you don't have a needs list prepared, but you're looking to spend, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 a year on a product, and you haven't written down a single need. Okay, but, well, I guess I'm going to help you figure that out, but yeah. It was surprising how many folks wanted to make decisions without actually...
But is this about the decision-making process in the organization, or is this about the process by which technology... Are we assuming that the decision's already made? Like, we need to raise X number of dollars in fundraising to support
it's organization? About, I think it's about validating ideas, right? Because a lot of... So if you're familiar with the concept, like Lean Startup, which is a book written by Eric Ries, 2012, really sparked this movement within the tech space to get people to really, like, validate assumptions that they're making. So his concept's pretty clear, right? He says, like, when you're sitting down brainstorming ideas for or features for a product or a website, you're making assumptions, right? Like, you don't actually know whether you need those things. Sometimes you have data to support it, sometimes, but most times you don't. So it's like, well, take the things that you know you don't really have data to prove that you need, and then go out and design like really quick tests or experiments to go out and validate those ideas.
Well, I can think of the biggest objection to that right off the top of my head, which is you're forming a relationship with a new vendor. You have to put out an RFP, and so maybe you're doing a little bit of thinking. That process forces you to decide, like, okay, we want a website that does A, B, C, D. And then you throw that out there, and then you get introduced to a new organization, and you commit a lot of money, and you're like, I'm not going to just say, like, hey, the solution, we got to find out. Like, I'm giving you... $100,000.
Right.
I want you to tell me what the solution is, right? Why should I hire you?
Yeah.
So then you have to reframe the conversation and say what? Like, how do you say, well, you know, in the proposal, we promised that we would spend $50,000 integrating you with Salesforce, and that's going to be the way you're going to, you know, track your whatever.
I think it depends. Like, something like Salesforce integration, like, those types of integrations, you can kind of assume you probably need, right? It's typically more around testing, like, front-facing features. Like, do you need a blog? Do you need a, you know... No, you do not.
I'm shaking my head no. You probably don't.
You need a podcast, though.
Yes. Yeah.
You need that crazy, like, quiz feature, right? Or something like that. Or that mapping feature.
Yes, the complicated quiz feature that, like, collects demographic information.
Right.
Costs $10,000 to develop.
Yeah.
Takes up a lot of time.
Yeah. I would say more times than not, it's more like validating, not so much as the organization need it, but do your users really want this, right? Like going out and saying, hey, is this going to add value to the lives of the people who are coming to our site or using our product?
I feel like the retort, though, is always the Steve Jobs Apple approach, which is users don't know what they want because they've never seen it. So they take the approach that it's their responsibility to show them. Like they're the leaders in that space, which I've gotten that before, where I say, is this something really that you need? And there's no data ever to back it up. I can only think of two organizations I've ever worked with that had actually done any really in-depth internal analysis before approaching these projects. Usually, it's more what those individuals in charge want, and so and sometimes it's completely. Completely different from in reality what the users want, whether that's, you know, you're sending emails, whether you're have that blog post or you're responsible for posting meme images to your Twitter and Facebook account. It's incredible all these needs that will get piled on because they're just what the people involved in the decision making process want, but not necessarily what actually gets views, clicks, and drives engagement for the organization.
Right, right. And one thing that really drove me to this lean methodology was this, Eric, you said it shouldn't cost a lot of money or take a lot of time to validate these ideas, right? Like, you can within a couple of days if you have an assumption that, hey, you know, maybe we want to add this poll feature to our website, right? You can actually build, like, a prototype possibly using paper, using wireframes to test that out and just put it in front of users and get some feedback on whether people find that to be valuable or not. So it's something that could be done fairly easily if done right. Right. I think a big assumption people make when they think about validating or prototyping, they assume that it requires a lot of investment. It's going to take away from budget, but in the long run, it can actually save from a lot of investment because when we get the long-term ownership of that product, you know, probably within 3 to 5 years, that organization's doing a complete redesign because they didn't spend that time validating those ideas up front, and their site's not performing the way that they assumed it would.
So I guess how do you, when you're working with a client, how do you shift that focus? I'll say my my kind of methodology has always been about the idea of engagement. You know, what drives it? Because at the end of the day, it's engagement, whether it's a view, a click, a read, a donation, you name it. For me, it's always been engagement. But do you have any other tools in your toolbox that you use to kind of reframe that conversation?
Reframe the conversation to get the client to buy into it?
To buy in the idea of actually doing the test, right? To actually
spend the money testing before you like take that little bit of money that you have to just build the solution.
Yeah. My take on it is don't force it on a client. Like, there's going to be clients that just don't want to do it. And usually, like, we'll have it baked into a contract, right? Like, we'll have it be part of the pitch that we're making. And if the client's not bought in, then they don't pay for it. Even if you force a client to do that and they're not bought into the concept, they're not going to actually use the data. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this with clients in the past. Like, you can try as hard and make as many arguments as you want, but if they don't actually think that there's other ideas out there that may actually be better.
So does your relationship start out like, hey, you know what, you want to have a new product, a new service online. We're going to give you $10,000 to build it. You say, you know what, why don't you give us $2,000 to test whether that's what you need.
Yep.
And then our solution, our preconceived solution is the right one. Right. Or do you say, give us $12,000 and we'll test it and we'll build it once we figure out what we need?
I think it's better to actually have it be part of a larger project. Like, if an organization says, hey, we have a budget of, you know, $20,000, $30,000 to build a website, if you're probably doing some kind of like planning or strategy work as part of that, like, bake it into the way that you do strategy, right? It can actually be part of the methodology by how you go about actually coming up with like features.
So you have like this is almost like a development methodology where you've got a process where when you sit down with the client, you've got the contract, mm-hmm. your kickoff meeting, and then you do a series of exercises or something.
Right. Yeah.
And you're testing five assumptions that were in the RFP.
Right. Yeah. Because you're going to go through your ideas and some of the things you're going to say like, hey, we know that we need these things. Right. Like Salesforce integration might be one. Like, we need to have all that information in our CRM. But again, back to that, like, some of the small features.
Are you testing, like, the navigation?
It could be the navigation. It's really anything that
you... Or is this a donation form, or...
But even with the integration, though, this is something I came up with a lot, was the first conversation. It's, I need real-time Salesforce integration with everything. All my data has to sync both ways. And then you start working on it, and you're like, oh, really, you only need these 20 fields once a week, and it's one single direction.
So you've got your content strategy and let's call it your technology strategy, and you want to test both of those things. So what are the kind of the common first thing that you might do?
The first things that you might want to test.
You just had the kickoff meeting. Everybody's excited. Mm-hmm. You're like, we're going to schedule a series of 10 2-hour meetings with all of your staff and put yellow sticky notes on a wall or what?
It varies. I like to do like lightweight wireframing and doing user testing of those. Like, we'll do a brainstorm and say, hey, we think these items should be in the navigation, or we should have this particular content on the homepage. Like, actually rapidly build out some prototype of that and then put it in front of users and have them react to it. So what you're testing really varies on the client.
We're breaking for not that I'm not interested in what you're saying. I should have timed it when you were done.
These guys are double fisting here, turning into a kegger.
The reason I'm here is not for this conversation. This is Stiegel Radler, beer with fruit soda.
It's pretty good.
It's a summer beer.
Grapefruit and like a pilsner or something?
Well, they're twist caps, so you gotta be...
Oh,
it's like Tecate with Sprite.
That's not a satisfying sound.
Such a sad...
Yeah. Right. I think cans still take the lead for the best audio beer.
Yeah.
The most audio satisfaction. I'm sorry. I totally interrupted
you. Wireframing.
For a beer break.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
What are we talking about? Vertigo?
I think I got everything out. No, it was really like... I like user testing as a concept. I think if you can quickly build out a prototype, whether it be with paper or wireframes, HTML if you have the time, and put it in front of users and get feedback. I think that's typically the easiest way.
And you're going to test everything. You're going to test your navigation system. You're going to test a couple pictures on the homepage. You're going to test...
I wouldn't say test everything. Like, there's certain things that you just know are going to work well, right? Like, you have data that probably...
I built 100 of these. Trust me. This is
right. Or you have metrics from, like, the older version of the website that show you, like, hey, this is the most popular content. We should probably use this information to kind of guide how we put our navigation together.
So what are the things you're looking to test then?
It kind of varies from project to project. Like one example, we were recently doing a project where we're doing user testing on a workflow system for the back end of the CMS. So we weren't actually testing with front end users. We're actually testing whether that workflow system worked for approving content on the back end of the system.
You just dropped, I think, maybe the word of the week, and that's user stories for folks that, and it has, I don't think it's come up on any of our previous podcasts so far. Do you want to tell folks what user stories are?
Yeah, user stories are short descriptions of functionality that are just adding some amount of value to a particular audience base, right? So it's really used to describe for developers what functionality a user is expecting and why they want it. It's something mainly used in Agile methodologies, though I think it's starting to get adopted in some other areas.
I think a lot of people might be vaguely familiar with the concept. I don't know how many actually follow it pretty diligently enough to make it worthwhile. Maybe it's worth talking about that a little bit, because basically what you're doing is you're getting together, having a kind of a brainstorming session like, these are all the things our website needs to do, and you frame it in terms of when the user comes to the site or when the admin logs into the site, whoever is using the site or whatever your key audience is, you frame it in terms of them being able to accomplish a task.
Right. It's like, as a user, I want to be able to do X because of Y.
And you keep it very lean. Like, it's no, it's not like, and Y, and Y, and Z, and D, and X. It's just user does Y.
Right.
And then you probably do some sort of an exercise where you gain consensus about what those top user stories are.
Yeah, I'm finding writing user stories is much more art than science. Like, there's, depending on who you talk to, everyone has their slightly different take on it. There are some best practices out there, but...
A big part of what user stories is also useful for, though, is figuring out where the trends are and where the patterns start to emerge, right? Yeah. And those are, in Agile, called epics, where you can actually start seeing, a group of user stories, maybe 20 of the user stories fall under the category of, event sign-up or something like that. Yeah. But those become bigger projects in and of themselves.
Right. Yeah, the whole concept of an epic is like, it's a large user story that at some point gets broken down, right? Like, you write an epic for, say, maybe a event registration functionality, and that just describes that the user wants to be able to register for events on your website because they want to volunteer in their community. And when you get to actually having deeper conversations about what that functionality needs to be, you break that epic down into like more detailed user stories.
So what are some, so you talked about a user story with your last client, or we didn't talk about user stories, but you talked about the last client, which was workflow. So it's a back-end administrative system. So what kinds of stories were you collecting that were motivating the testing?
Kind of like user stories?
Yeah.
We weren't actually using user stories for the testing. So typically I recommend, like, after you've actually validated an idea, then write your user stories, right? Because then you actually know what you're going to be building. I try not to write user stories when we're doing just upfront testing, because it takes a lot of time to go through and rewrite stories, and you can... Yeah.
So you don't do the user story first. You do the testing first.
Yeah. And then write your user stories.
Give us an example of something that recently... Were this applied very well or didn't go well?
It didn't go well?
Something we might learn something from.
Sure. Actually, it's actually been going fairly well recently.
Airplane, by the way. We're also in the path of Reagan National.
Yeah, we're about a mile away from Reagan National.
But we're outside because it's like 75 degrees and there's not a cloud in the sky, and it's a lovely evening to sit outside in Alexandria.
Yeah. I can actually give an interesting example where we did some user testing on a particular feature for a site, which was the functionality would allow people to share content between different brand websites. It's for a fairly large organization that had multiple sites for different, like, local divisions, right? They wanted to be able to say, if you're, a division in England and you create an interesting campaign, we want somebody to easily be able to copy a piece of content from, like, that site to our local site and just reproduce that campaign page.
Makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it wasn't actually the testing that was problematic. It was more actually getting people bought in on the idea. So sometimes, especially if you're working with an existing website, we're working with multiple vendors, it actually became somewhat of a contentious topic, because you're then showing somebody data that showed them that they were probably wrong the first time around when they estimated something, right? So you have to, there's a lot of politics involved with testing as well. It's not just the science of user testing. you have to think strategically about how are you going to use this data? Like, what is the best way to approach, like, exposing the client to this, and how do you actually use this data to convince them to go in a certain direction?
So, I'm still trying to figure out if you're the client and you are thinking about testing the assumptions. I guess I'm thinking of going back to the methodology. Like, what are the first steps? What do I do next?
Oh, in terms of steps, yes. So the there's actually a really good book called Lean UX, which is taking like the lean methodology and shows you how to apply it to user experience design. Has some really good kind of first steps for you to go through. First, it's to declare your assumptions as hypotheses, right? Write down statements that clearly state, here are the things we want to test. And then once you've identified what are the things you need to prove out, you design your experiment. You say, for this particular thing, we're going to do user testing. For this other thing, we may do card sorting. Or for this other thing, we may just sit down with like a group and do some
And how do you know which exercise to use for which situation?
It kind of depends on what you're testing. Like if you're testing navigation organization, doing like card sorting is a good way to do it. I tend to default to doing like user testing, like actually doing like clickable wireframes or
give someone a task and say
And give them a task, like doing that type of user testing. I feel like you can test more, almost most things that you want to actually prove out within a website or a product, you can do with that type of validation.
Yeah, so. And if you're building a Drupal or a WordPress site, you're actually building.
You can actually do it within Drupal, yeah.
The actual publishing system as your, you could mock up pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's actually a great way to test content types even, where you can build out your content type, have the user go and say, hey, we want you to enter 5 or 10 pieces of content, using this form, and then you start to identify what the problems were.
What are some other tools
That you can use?
Any tools to build clickable wireframes really easy if you don't know HTML? Or?
Yeah, there's a few. Mockflow is one. Balsamiq is another. Mockflow, we're using it at Foresight for quite some time. Envision is a tool that allows you to take wireframes that you may build in like InDesign or Photoshop and just make them clickable. Mm-hmm. It requires a little bit more work, but you get the higher fidelity wireframe that you're probably designing with like an OmniGraph or InDesign.
So for the, because we know we're going to have executive directors and communications and development directors listening to this podcast, let's say one of those individuals is listening and they've got a couple $1,000, $5,000 left in their budget this year, and it's something they want to invest in. They know they don't have the money up front to have a large project, but if they can prove a need through some of this testing, they might be able to get that budget the next year around. What are some of the questions that they could throw out there either in an RFP or to the consultants they work with and say, I mean, you're not just going to go, hey, I want to do, lean user testing. You got to come to them with an idea. So I guess, how would you shape that conversation so they can approach their consultants or put out, questions to the consultants that they've worked with?
I would say I would almost recommend before bringing in a consultant, having some internal conversations to identify what the problem is that you're really trying to solve. Because it's hard to really bring in a consultant and say, hey, we have this pocket of money and we want you to fix this entire website without really knowing what the core problem is. Because you're going to spend a lot of time up front discovering what that problem is. So really identify what that problem is that you're trying to solve for. And then shape your RFP around that. If you know that it's improving donations, it might be improving email signups. Like, specifically focus your RFP on looking for individual vendors or consultants that can come in and actually help you optimize those particular features of your site. It also helps you, weed through the consultants that are available to you.
So it sounds like another good tool to have in your back pocket would something that would be real simple A/B testing, if you're going to do, a form, for instance.
Yeah.
Any software that you've used?
Optimizely, I think, is probably the leading tool. I was a little reluctant to use it at first. I kind of preferred using Google Content Experiments. But, I think Optimizely has kind of proven to be the best platform out there.
It's so easy.
It is, yeah. It's point and click.
It's like the MailChimp of A/B testing.
I would almost say easier than MailChimp.
That's kind of scary.
Yeah.
And what's the Google product you're talking about?
Google Content Experiments. It's just a feature of Google Analytics that allows you to enter a couple URLs that you want to split test. And it just randomly will display one of the two variations of the pages.
When someone makes a call on a URL, it will randomly display. Oh, I didn't know that. And then that goes right into your Google Analytics account.
Yeah. It will actually track the conversion. You tell it what the landing page is that the person's converting on, and it will actually track the conversion and give you a metric Sherlock, which is the one that improves. You can actually set it to after a certain amount of time, start displaying the best performing page after the experiment.
Oh, that's nice.
So it saves you a little bit of work.
But it's a little bit more work to run. It's a little bit more complex.
Yeah, it takes more time because it doesn't give you a tool for building out the page where Optimizely, it's like a WYSIWYG. You can just log in and actually edit your site. And it uses jQuery to do an override of, like, the page that you're testing. So you can actually, like, through a WYSIWYG editor, make all these changes pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. But in that case, you're at the end of the process, which is you're creating two separate donation pages, and then you just pick the one you like, or you take lessons from whichever one performed better, and then you make a new one. But what if you're more in the beginning stages of, like, oh, we've just tested, you know, how our homepage is going to look? Then what's the next step toward getting those lessons and applying them into the development cycle?
You can use those, like, whatever you learn. Like, if you validated your idea, right, you say that, you know, if you're testing a homepage carousel and whether that's going to get people to click,
it won't. The answer is no, right?
The answer is no. Right.
Brian likes to tell people that.
What? No?
What's the percentage of people that ever see the second picture?
Oh, on a slide? You don't want to know. It's sad.
Like
everybody loves their slider because they get to put 30 pieces of content above the fold. On
you know,
their
and
page.
That's actually not that's a reason to do it. I mean, even if no
you're
one sees
crush
it,
your page
there's political gain to be made.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, with competing fiefdoms within an organization.
That's actually a fairly good argument. I'll say,
just like, make them lazy load, so all the people that never see them are not loading them on your page.
Like, I agree. Carousels do perform poorly, and they use it. Like, there's just a lot of usability testing out there, or data out there that shows they're not. It's not the most usable tool, but you're right. Like, if it comes down to politics, and you have five different teams that are vying for some homepage real estate, and you want to bury the four other teams, just put them on slide 2 through 5.
Yeah. Right. If you don't want to bury them, an easy option is just to get it so your slider loads a random slide upon initial page load.
Yes.
And so that'll sort through all 5, 15, whatever amount of slides you have.
Or what you should do is figure out, after you do that, see which slide performs the best and people click, and then have that load first.
I mean, that's all. That would be great. But the adage is you don't want to hide content, and a slide is content, and you're hiding it.
Yeah, you should just have the page be longer is really what the point is.
And people are figuring that out with navigation now. It's been interesting to watch the progression into responsive design.
Yeah.
And it's like every website's trying something new with their navigation menu.
Yeah.
There's no magic answer there just yet. But
well, it's kind of interesting that, like, mega menus came around as, like, a way to kind of squash advertising into menus in some way. And responsive design completely killed that idea, right? Because mega menus don't work on mobile phones.
And what's,
or tablets.
What's a mega menu?
It's just when you have a drop-down, you'll get a flyout that has, like, an image or a video.
Or another slideshow.
Or a slideshow. I have actually seen flyouts in navigation that have a slideshow within the drop-down. It's kind of scary.
Should be banned.
Yes.
So what are some other low-hanging fruit in terms of, like, maybe you've got a site and you just want to increase the performance of something or attract a specific audience? Not that you're doing a big development project and you want to spend a lot of money. What are some handy little tools or exercises that you've found to be really useful?
I always like the exercise of actually testing out homepage content. It's very simple thing to do, to go through, like, your site and just test, like, headlines, testing images that you're using. Also navigation. I feel like those are two.
And the homepage, really, I mean, if that's oftentimes 80% of your traffic, unless you are designing your site not to be that way, then that's going to get you the most mileage off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I found, like, looking at other industries like e-commerce or media sites, right? Like, they're not getting most of their traffic to their homepage. Mm-hmm. But, like, for most nonprofits, if somebody wants to learn about your organization, they're going to your homepage more so than any other page. And you really want to direct them to whatever action you want them to take quickly. I always like to say, like, if you have a carousel and you're having issues with having too many messages on your homepage, it's not a content problem, it's a communication problem. Like, you have to really reassess your communication strategy and your messaging. Like, what are you really trying to say to people on your homepage? And through, like, A/B testing and user testing, you can refine that and really drive up the amount of people you're sending to different paths within your site.
That's cool. It's almost like a laboratory for bettering your organization, regardless of whether it has to do with your making your website better. It's like, you know, it's just an easy means of doing some market testing.
Yeah.
Anything else that we would want to talk about in terms of like low hanging fruit though? Like, are there software that you found is just really great, or an exercise that you almost always suggest because it, you know, it tells them something they don't know or is really easy to implement?
Nothing that's coming to mind. We've talked about a lot of things.
The lesson is you have to hire someone like you.
Right. Shoot me an email and we'll talk.
I guess I'd add that page speed is one of those things that if your website is slow, it doesn't matter if it's gorgeous. Yeah. If it takes 15 seconds to load and somebody's going to close out that tab after 10, they're never going to see your content. And so page speed is one of those things that will follow you across your website. So if you know your website is performing slow, including on mobile, you got to get that addressed. There's no excuse.
So there's some basic tests you should run, regardless of whether you even have anything interesting to ask. You just say, like, is it performing?
2 seconds
is the goal. Is it mobile? Does it show up good on mobile? Yeah. Are there some other baseline ones that are sort of...
Google Analytics actually gives you reports now on your site speed. So you can actually go in and with your regular web metrics, just actually see how quickly or slowly your site's loading.
What's your experience been with that? I always feel like it's showing me the most pessimistic view of the site. It's always much higher than, and it's always anecdotal, but my own personal experience and what I hear other people reporting for the site, it always seems to be a little bit slower.
Yeah. Well, it's a benchmark, right?
Like, yeah.
With Google Analytics, for almost every metric in the software, like, I've heard people kind of dispute, like, site visits are always off, right? If you compare it to, like, Omniture, some other software. But it's more about tracking, like, benchmarks. Like, are you seeing your site speed, like, decrease or increase over time? Like, if you're getting spikes in traffic, is it just taking a long time to load? So I think, you know, it's a better tool for looking at the actual, like, change in time, like the change in speed over time versus, like, trying to get an exact amount. Like, there's site benchmarking software out there for doing, like, load testing.
I'm surprised Google Analytics hasn't moved to some DNS model for page tracking. So you actually would set up your domain through it. So you actually would hit the Google servers before the page ever loads.
Whatever happened to the Google domain service? Did they ever launch that?
It's 8.8.8.8. Still works, but it's not for page tracking. It's just your own DNS lookup.
Okay.
Any Google employee listening, there you go. It's a billion-dollar idea.
Yeah.
Maybe not a billion.
So what's next? What's next in the world of testing assumptions?
What's next in the world?
What are you interested to try to do, or is there any technology that you're excited about?
Technology. I'm more interested in, like, different research methods. Like, I want to start doing more, like, longitudinal studies, like testing. Are you actually changing user behavior over time using a product? Something I've been fascinated by, looking at, like, products like Weight Watchers and you know. Tinder even is changing the way that people are, like, approaching dating online. Just, like, how are you actually changing human behavior?
Follow the Tinder model.
Every app is the Tinder of something. The Tinder of some industry. So, yeah. But, yeah, that's actually an interesting space that I've been...
Is there something you could do that on a very basic level to start tracking that? I'm trying to think. You have to authenticate somebody in order to track them, I assume.
Or you'd have to do this broadly,
just saying, like, you know, everybody who comes to our site, how are they behaving?
You probably need to authenticate at that point. It's like you're building some kind of, like, platform or community site where people are logging in and they're doing something, and you're tracking the change of their behavior over time. So it requires a lot of data, probably months, if not years, of research. But
so this would have to be for a site that is kind of mission critical, like it's revenue generating, or, you know, it's a social site that, you know, is a product.
But there's a lot of quick things you can do. Like, there's software that you can add to your site for collecting, like, surveys, right? Like, Poll Daddy is one of my favorite ones. You can create, like, really simple...
Is that,
like,
better than SurveyMonkey?
I like it just because it provides, like, I think, a nicer user experience, and you can actually embed the survey on a page on your site. So you can just create simple surveys asking people for feedback. Send an email to your users asking them, you know, what do you think of this campaign, or what do you think about, like, this feature on our site? It's like, I think the basic premise is, like, actually start talking to your users and try and get a sense of, like, what they want. What are their needs? And you can start to actually gather those trends and, like, see that within, you know, talking to 5 to 7, maybe 10 users.
Actually, I like the trend that I've seen, which surveys have been there for years. Mm-hmm. But in the last probably 6 months, I've seen a trend towards just single yes-no surveys.
Yes.
Have you found what you're looking for? Because at the end of the day, that's all that matters. Either I did or I didn't.
Yeah.
And, yeah, if you could sit that user down, you're going to ask them 20 questions. But mm-hmm. you're going to get more answers if it's a simple yes or no. And really, that's what I want to know. Like, if at its core, I could only ask one question of a user. Did you find what you were looking for is probably going to be it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the Net Promoter Score, which was like a mm-hmm. popular business metric for a while. That it was just a simple question of, like, would you recommend this product to mm-hmm. a friend, right? Like, applying that to your organization. Like, asking your user, like, would they recommend their friend, like, that a friend volunteer with you or that they donate to your organization? And track how people are responding over time, right? If you're seeing a decrease in that, probably need to tweak things, right?
I think Zendesk does that, right?
Yeah.
At the end, you can turn that on so it'll ask someone, you know, would you, yeah, the net promoter question, like, would you recommend mm-hmm. whatever service mm-hmm. to a friend?
Yeah, I'm actually seeing this a lot in government websites. So usability.gov has a feature where if you read a particular page or article, at the bottom it just asks you, was this content helpful? And you mark yes or no. And it doesn't actually expose to you. It's not like a rating system. It doesn't expose to the users whether, like, how many people found it useful or not. But it's data they're collecting on the back end to find, you know, of the number of people who are coming to your site, how many people found that page useful, right? It's just a simple division, and you can probably generate just, like, a score that you're using to track that over time.
It's an easy way to find low-hanging fruit.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I know you've been interested in these big picture things for a while. We work together, and I think these are always the kinds of things that you get animated about, you know,
yep.
When you're talking to clients or when you're going to happy hours and chatting yeah. with other techie-minded folks.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this start? How did your passion for digital marketing and content start?
Oh, that's a complicated question. I'll give you the short version. I actually started, like, I've had an interest since high school. Like, when I graduated high school, I knew I wanted to get into, like, media, something related to technology.
Are you allowed to tell us when you graduated high school, just to give a
yes,
sense
of 99, yeah, I'm not, okay. My age doesn't fear me, it doesn't scare me. I'll let people know how old I am. 34.
Okay, so yeah. Anyway, there was a lot of optimism about technology in 1999.
Yeah, and it faded through college. I got more into, like, advocacy and became a community organizer. But while I was doing organizing, I always had this question in the back of my mind while we did some engagement campaigns. Like, can technology actually change the way that people, like, vote, right? Because we found that people, like, especially for local elections, people didn't even know that there was an election going on. But, like, can you use technology in some way to change people's engagement with the political mm-hmm. process? So that's how, like, I started getting more involved in, like, digital advocacy, working on political campaigns more in a digital capacity, and, you know, years on the road, here I am.
But you worked for a Senate candidate, right?
I did. You worked
on some political campaigns. Was mm-hmm. that your first sort of introduction to...
It was, yeah. I attended the New Organizing Institute training. I was part of the first class. Then went to work for 21st Century Democrats for a little bit. Then worked on a couple... I actually started doing nonprofit consulting and doing some campaign work on the side, kind of in parallel. And then went on to do work on a few federal races after 2009. Just started doing freelance work.
So how is that? How has the use of technology changed since then?
In the sector?
In the campaign, are you doing any more political work?
No, I haven't done political work since 2010. But, I mean, it's very similar to the nonprofit space, and, I mean, it may sound cynical, but I don't think it's actually changed a lot in the past, like, 5 or 6 years.
Mm, it's all about emails. Is that right?
Yeah, but even like, the technology available, I feel is kind of lagging behind. I think we're at the...
Well, it brought down price. I think that was the big thing.
Yeah.
That's really... The technology hasn't really improved very much,
yeah.
but now
it's more
people can afford it.
Yeah, it's much more accessible, and I think we've seen accessibility of technology just open across the spectrum, right, in social media and, like, all the open source, like, content management systems are just a lot of options that organizations have out there to be able to start, like, a digital campaign or set up a web presence pretty quickly.
Well, so the price comes down, we're going to see more adoption and then ideally more innovation.
Yeah.
I think at least the conversation, mm-hmm. more of these high-level strategy components come into play than they did 5 years ago.
Yeah.
there, whether the person asking the question knows exactly what it is, they're at least smart enough to know this is probably something they should be talking about.
Right. I think part of what might be causing a delay in, like, the innovation in the technology space is that a lot of what's done in digital in the and it happens in most sectors, but especially in the nonprofit sector, is driven by offline tactics that were adopted for online, right? Like, direct mail was a way to reach people and do fundraising, and that was replaced by email, right?
Yeah, even the vernacular remains. You ever wonder why something is named that way in digital? It's probably because it was, some direct mail.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing with petitions. And that, like, those tactics are still probably very prevalent in the space. And although you're seeing diminishing return on a lot of those tactics, with the exception of maybe email, I think fundraising is one area where you haven't seen a lot of, like, decrease. There's really not a lot of innovation, I think, just across the social sector. Where you're seeing some of that innovation is really in the application of, like, behavioral economics, right, to social change. Like, how are people trying to, like, use psychology and this whole, like, nudge concept to change people's behavior? So it's not about getting people to sign a petition or to, you know, raise a certain amount of money. It's more about, like, how do we get people to stop smoking? How do you get people to, you know, actually commit to losing weight over the...
Well, then it gets back to more traditional marketing concepts of you got to give them the message 30 times.
Yes.
And then on the 30th time, they're going to hit send or they're going to hit donate. Or
look at a lot of e-commerce solutions and what they're doing. I mean, we talk about, you know, one-click donate. I mean, how long is one-click Amazon purchases existed for? Way before...
years,
You know, the nonprofit space ever started talking about it. But that technology has existed for a long time.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are going to innovate. They're going to test everything because that's where the money's at. And even though the money's there for nonprofits, it's hard to invest in something that doesn't have a proven outcome, right? Yeah. They're less willing... Nonprofits are less willing to take really big risk. You know, no nonprofit is going to invest $100,000 to experiment with optimizing.
Right.
It's hard to get long term
funding, right? Because most organizations, if they're getting $100,000 or more for a website or some product they're trying to build, they have to actually report back to the organization that gave them that money that there was some success. Right, like an organization, like a foundation, is probably not going to give an organization $500,000 or $200,000 and say, "Hey, here, go fail, but come back and tell us what you learned." Right, but the things you learn from failure can actually create much greater success in the future. So it's actually not a lost investment. Like if you could actually get organizations that are pulling their money together to, like, actually fail at some projects and see, like, experiment and see what could work and what
only
won't
if
work.
That failure is shared though.
Right,
which
the,
there's
the cost of the failure is shared.
Yeah,
and
cost,
usually you don't want to share your failure in a nonprofit, right? Like, there's literally no incentive. Nobody benefits.
Yeah,
you know, no one's going to get promoted because they made sure everyone else in the nonprofit space knew that they had a horrible, you know, failure over the last 12 months.
The startup community is kind of interesting in that they're starting to embrace failure, right? Like, every other day I see an article about, like, how it's why it's good to fail.
But it's such a weird...
That sounds like a rationalization.
A weird dance.
It really is.
I think it's a chance to get more PR. Yeah.
I think it is. But, like, there's this new event. It started in D.C. called Fuck Up Tuesdays or Fuck Up Days, something.
You post your failures on Tuesdays?
Yeah. Like, the whole concept is...
I do that every day on my Facebook page.
Yeah. Wait, you gather at this event and people volunteer to talk about one thing that they fucked up on in starting their startup, and they just share stories of failure, and it's just this interesting concept to kind of, like, build this culture of comfort in failure, right? Like, people don't want to share stories of them not doing well,
and then, you know, oftentimes we'll learn more, I think.
Right. And I mean, if you can share those failures in the nonprofit community, and not to say that it doesn't happen, like, I think NOI has actually created a really great space where at their camps you've heard a lot of stories of people saying, hey, we tried this and it didn't actually work. But it's really about the culture, like creating a space where people feel comfortable doing that.
And I think you're right. I think the culture is shifting a little bit. It's not about the bottom line immediate performance as much as the conversation maybe. What are your recent failures? Do you have any that you can catalog for us?
Recent failures?
Moral, personal, technological, anything.
Professional I probably can't share given client relationship, but personal failures... I threw out my knee trying to do squats at the gym. I'll share that. I actually probably...
I know. And you go in there and you just do, like, you get really excited, you do a shitload of weight, and then you hurt
yeah,
yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I was trying to squat more than I'd ever tried, and
That's actually a legitimate way. That's not a fat. That's like a humble brag. You're like, I was going for my personal record. Threw out my knee.
But, yeah. But the story is actually kind of embarrassing.
It's not like I dropped my pint of ice cream, and when I bent down, I threw out my back. Like,
it was quite the spectacle, though, because, like, the entire gym, when I turned around, the entire gym was watching.
Oh,
like,
my
I couldn't, I'd even make it all the way down.
Was there, like, a loud noise when you dropped 400 pounds?
Yeah,
because
the weight, instead of, like, dropping it backwards, I leaned forward, and the weight rolled, it rolled down my neck.
Oh.
Because my spot wasn't actually spotting me. So
are
just
you
like
bald
rolled
back there? I
no.
Can't see.
No, I had a bruise back there for a while, but it like rolled down my neck and
holy
fell
cow.
And made a really big sound, and I just kind of looked
rolled
around
into
shame.
The glass mirror and shattered everything.
That luckily it didn't, because that would have been an expensive mirror to replace. But
like, my gym membership's over.
Yeah.
Well, what we were talking about what lessons Amazon had for e-commerce. What about Tinder? What lessons do they have for us? I mean, it is mm-hmm. kind of a joke because it's kind of titillating, but. It's fucking successful, isn't it?
I've got one.
You got one?
Yeah. It was really interesting because it wasn't actually Tinder that I think did it, but they're benefiting from what was learned about human interaction.
Yep.
And that was that swiping is lower mental effort than tapping. And so there were previous apps, I don't know, let's just use Hot or Not, where you had to tap like one, you're going to, I'm interested in this in person, I'm not, to continue. And actually, the people figured this out through just the apps being popular, but then people started doing studies into it, and what they learned was that human effort to swipe something is much lower than to position your finger and make a mental click, yes or no. And so all the apps pretty much across the board are now transitioning to swipe maneuvers. So you look
Flipboard.
At... Yeah, I mean, you even look at like Google's material design, and it's all swipe in from the left, swipe in from the right. It's all about swiping now.
Yeah.
So is that what you tell your girlfriend?
It's all about swiping.
It's just swiping research, honey.
Yeah.
Don't worry about these. These apps are for work.
Yeah. Tinder's an interesting example because you're right. Like, I see a lot of apps adopting that kind of that UI design pattern. But it kind of goes back to this conversation we were having earlier about the three-step donation form, right? It's like people saw that work for Obama, and now you see every single donation page has like this three-step design. But it may not work for every audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've seen in this space a lot where, you know, you see great success with one organization, one campaign. Everybody adopts this, like, this approach, but then it's not having the same results. And I think this is where, like, another case for why you should do research and testing with your users, because one tactic may work really well for one organization, but it may not necessarily apply to your organization because demographics may be different. Culture may be different.
Well, I don't know if we were recording earlier when we were talking about the three-step donation form, but I was putting out there that I think it's bullshit. I think the only reason they saw increases in total giving was a novelty factor, and that likely it's on par with other mobile-optimized donation forms right now. I have no data to back this up, but...
But it's fucking bullshit, man.
It's bullshit. It's completely bullshit. I thought it was bullshit from the start. But you know, the novelty factor is real, though, so you can't completely write that off. But I'm not sold on the three-step donation form. I think it opens up a bigger question about optimizing giving for the mobile experience.
Yeah.
But three steps, like, I don't think it's some Goldilocks number.
Right. It could be four. It could be two.
Yeah.
Right.
So in closing, what are some big takeaways about you think that this is a fundamental change in the way people are approaching their websites?
Yeah, I think so. I think the big challenge for the nonprofit sector is really funding, right? Like, most organizations will probably have a hard time getting funding for that kind of research up front. But I think it's something that organizations could ask of their consultants if they do have a budget of, you know, $100,000, they can say, we want to allocate some portion of this to do research.
Just do some trials just to see how it goes,
right.
And some easy tests that don't cost a lot. And
yeah. And really, really look for, like, how can you do, like, the hallway test? Can you show this to five people in a Starbucks or five people at your organization and just get their feedback on
it? Because it might not necessarily be a technological thing. It might be literally going down to the Starbucks with a clipboard and asking a couple people a couple things.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of it could just be done with paper and sketches. So,
and actually, five is a really good number. Like, yeah. You ask five people the same question or show them the same page and tell them, you know, try to find your way to give, mm-hmm. You're going to uncover those problems pretty quickly. The big, you know, glaring 80% style problems, like, you're going to uncover them probably within the first five people you ask.
Yeah, I agree. I can't say that I've ever done user testing where I haven't, by a third or fourth test, seen the pattern, kind of had a sense of, like, how we need to translate. So
you're also, in this case, talking about more kind of subjective focus group-y kinds of things. You're not talking about large data samples that are statistically validated.
No, small qualitative research. It doesn't require you to interview thousands of people or hundreds of people. It can be, mm-hmm. you know, a handful.
Do you watch Silicon Valley?
I do not. I've avoided.
There's a recent episode with user focus group testing, yep. And it's going horrible.
That is such a fucking niche little joke. Like, it actually is. Is that a storyline within an episode?
It's hilarious. I mean, it's just a scene within an episode. And you know, on the other side is the CEO of the company, and the first person is like, "Yeah, this app's bullshit. Like, I don't like it." Like, that's his feedback.
Yeah.
And like, the guy leading the conversation is like, "How many other people think this app is, you know, bullshit or whatever?" They all raise their hands. And so the CEO on the backside is like, "Oh man, like, how bad is this? Is this like, you know, is this as bad as you know, this project or that project?" And his, I don't know. We don't know who she is because she's not in any of the other episodes. But she's just like, "It's Apple Maps bad."
Wow.
Which, yeah, it's totally bad. Like, if you don't follow Silicon Valley you know, culture, you're I don't know, maybe there's something you like about this, but it's so inside baseball, all the episodes.
Well, is there something to be said about the way you ask questions? Because obviously that influences dramatically what your responses are going to be.
Don't ask leading questions.
Unless you want a specific answer.
I harp on this a lot. They'll probably smile if they hear this.
How much more do you like A than B?
What's that?
How much more do you like A than B?
Right, exactly. It's like, hey, do you think this is nicer than the other one? It's like, don't lead your interviewee or your participant to answer the question a certain way, given keywords that you're using within your question. I can drastically throw off your results. Ask very open-ended, objective questions.
Any other keywords that we could drop right now?
I'm sure we'll figure it out.
What was the word of the day?
User stories.
Yes.
Data-driven decisions.
Agile. I love hate relationship with agile. That's another podcast topic.
Yeah, I'm sick of hearing people talk about agile. Yeah. So we'll stop it at that. Thanks for having us over, Rishay. We really appreciate it. And we'll hopefully see you soon.
Yep.
Come back for podcast
for more beer. And
yeah.
Cool.